I think that this is unequivocally far and away the most important problem in machine learning to solve, because if we do it, we will see like overnight increase in the amount of progress on the world's most important problems. And I just can't think of another way to spend my life.
Voices of the Data Economy, a podcast supported by Ocean Protocol Foundation. We bring to you the voices shaping the data economy and challenging it at the same time. We talk about breaking down data silos and equalizing access to data for all.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the new podcast about data economy. And we thought there was no one better than Andrew Trask, leader of OpenMind, to start the podcast with. I'm here with Diksha as the main co-host and Andrew Trask. Hi, Diksha. Hi, Andrew. The stage is yours.
Hello, both of you. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Great to see you.
Same here. So thank you for taking our time today. And I've actually been quite fascinated reading about you in the past few days. And I understand that you wear many hats. And one line that really stayed with me, which you said in one of your interviews around 2 years back, was that how you manage different facets of your career is that you focus on the intersection of cryptography and deep learning in whichever project you really take up. So I think it would be a good idea to start with, why did you particularly choose this focus? And how has your journey been focusing on this?
That's a good question. I originally... Before I came here to Oxford to do a PhD, I was working for a really awesome company back in Nashville called Digital Reasoning. They deliver sort of on-prem AI solutions. So basically, if you needed to do AI and machine learning on secret data that you couldn't put into the cloud, whether you were a member of the intelligence community or perhaps working at finance and investment bank, something like this, that was our job. And one of the things that was really challenging there, because we did lots of with natural language processing and with AI and deep learning. And at the time, I thought that I was learning a lot about sort of natural language processing and how to work with language, and I was. However, what I also became very familiar with is just how challenging it is to work with, the world's most sensitive and valuable information, right? And as it turns out, the world's most sensitive and valuable information is exactly what you need if you need to solve the world's most important problems. These are often problems about people, and we talk about this in the context of privacy, but also it's just really, really important problems in general that might just be proprietary in nature just because of how valuable they are. And so then when I came to school here, to continue my education, I was intended to do a PhD on natural language processing, specifically or on like long-term memory and neural memory. And about 9 months in, I started learning about these techniques like homomorphic encryption, secure multi-party computation, zero knowledge proofs, secure hardware. And it just started to become really clear to me that the big things that have happened in sort of AI and machine learning, like the big moments, Deep Blue beating Garry Kasparov or IBM Watson defeating Ken Jennings and winning the game at Jeopardy. And even the most recent ones like ImageNet competition or AlphaGo beating Lee Sedol. And of course, last year, AlphaStar. There's a really big component of these that are actually booms in data and compute as much, and in some cases more than they are booms in the modeling innovations that created them. And that to me, and this was really bolstered and seeded by my PhD supervisor. When I first sat down in his office on my first day, he said, "All right, Andrew, everyone is going to want to work on model development. Everyone's going to want to work on making the next great, LSTM or transformer model or whatever. But if you look across history, the big booms come when we have a massive new data set that we just weren't able to work with before." And that really stuck with me. And now when I look across history, when Garry Kasparov beat Deep Blue, shortly before that was released the largest collection of Grandmaster games. It was like 25 million games for people to be able to train models on. When IBM Watson won the one Jeopardy. That was shortly after, I believe it was Wikipedia, had released like a massive structured analysis, structured data set and corpus derived from their Wikipedia articles and like a lot of the metadata that was inside them. And if you look at the innovations that we had in image processing, like ImageNet and GPUs, allowed us to process millions and millions of images like never. And then we got this huge boom again in AI progress then. And even in the latest chapters, if you look at something like AlphaGo, it's training on, presumably millions and millions and millions of Go games, right? Like we're able to synthesize basically infinite numbers of training examples. And so then when I sit back and I think, okay, what are the world's most important problems, right? Things like cancer or disinformation or I guess healthcare is sort of the easiest to work with, coronavirus, right? Mm-hmm. If I wanted to go work on cancer right now, so like I have several colleagues here at Oxford who are working on cancer research, it takes them months to get access to a data set. I mean, it's like paperwork and background checks and sending in passports and IDs. And sometimes they have to go on site to like a private virtual cloud just to work with one hospital's big data set. Right. And it's not even that big because it's just from one hospital. And this mirrors my own experience before I was in my PhD. Like if we wanted to go work with a data set of one of our customers, we'd fly to New York, go through physical security and then be in a bunker somewhere working with a data set. So, we have this disparity. Like on the one hand, if I want to make the world's most powerful handwritten digit classifier, I can pip install access to MNIST in like 2 seconds and 30 seconds later, git clone, the world's top MNIST model, train it in on a GPU. And 10 minutes later, I've got, one of the world's most accurate MNIST classifiers, doing handwritten digit at, superhuman ability, if that's such a thing. But if I wanted to train the world's most accurate cancer classifier, I've got to, like far from just pip install, I've got to dedicate a portion of my life just to get access to probably not enough data at one institution. And that right there, that is the inflection point of what I think is the most important problem to solve in machine learning. And 3 years ago when I started investigating this and shortly thereafter went to my supervisor and said like, this is it. Right. I mean, this like, yes, if I were to make the world's next great, transformer or whatever, that would obviously be very impactful. It would make lots of machine learning models more accurate. But if we solve this problem, every single field that is collecting data that is sensitive or valuable in nature will experience, 100 or 1,000x increase in the availability of that data virtually overnight. And what's even more exciting about this problem is that so many of the important subproblems have already been solved in a disparate set of fields, across cryptography, across policy, across even machine learning, things like federated learning. And what's lacking is really to have all these sort of combined together, if that makes sense. Like it's the ensemble of these techniques that's really missing. And the fastest change doesn't come when you pick a really hard problem, make it all the way out to the forefront of that problem, and then push it a little bit further, alongside 1,000 other people who are also pushing in that direction. And then you put out a thesis and you did it, right? I mean, that's the hardest thing. The really big changes come when there's two really deep verticals, right? With thousands of people pushing ahead and you go, hey, let's push these together. Let's merge these together because it just becomes an absolute land grab for ideas between these two. I mean, you want to look at examples of that. Look at deep learning and reinforcement learning. Like now it's hard to even think about either of them opposed from the other. But, 5-10 years ago, like these were totally different subjects, right? I mean, they were in totally, they were in different departments at different conferences doing different things. And we've seen a huge dearth in progress by people noticing, hey, if we combine these together, deep learning systems get infinite amounts of training data, which is what they need. And reinforcement learning systems get powerfully biased, positively biased models that can solve really interesting problems. So when you ask like, why did I choose this problem? It's because, like, if you look across sort of the evidence from the history of machine learning of what drives progress, and you look at where we're sitting today, I think that this is unequivocally far and away the most important problem in machine learning to solve, because if we do it, we will see like overnight increase in the amount of progress on the world's most important problems. And I just can't think of another way to spend my life.
Well, that was legendary. So,
absolutely.
You know, this is one of those situations that you're not just going to 10x, as Silicon Valley folks like to say. It's more like a 1000x. So, I'm curious about is, as you were talking, I thought, so, you know, this sounds like a great idea. We're going to enable people, data scientists, machine learning people, to access data that they don't actually own. They just have access to it, right? But don't you have to convince all those, I don't want to say old school, but all those organizations that are sitting on heaps and heaps of data to trust your approach? Because as far as I know, OpenMind is not just using, you know, we're using Intel SGX Secure Enclave. Trust us, it's Intel. You know, there are a bunch of projects that have this approach. And as far as I know, they haven't been very successful, at least it hasn't scaled. But you are, as you said, you're kind of collecting all these different tried and proven tested approaches, bringing them together, building the connective tissue with PyGrid. But still, you have this problem. Like, how do you convince all the, you know, hospitals of the world, governments, you know, do you have an answer for this? Like, what has been your experience so far?
Man, such a great question. Gosh, where to begin?
Sorry for the two good questions.
No, it's great. It's absolutely the right question to ask, right? How do you build trust in new technology? And the starting point is, and at first, I of course have to acknowledge this, we're not inventing the tools that we're building, right? I mean, we didn't invent differential privacy. Cynthia Dwork did, right? We didn't invent secure multi-party computation, zero knowledge proofs. We didn't invent any of these things, right? And so there's already a certain tailwind that's coming as people learn more about what these are about, and as sort of community dynamics unfold in the way in which cultures build trust in anything. The truth is, like, you know, why do you get on a plane and fly around, right? Or better question, you know, 6 months ago, why were you willing to get in a plane and fly around when you have no idea how it works? Well, it's because lots of other people are doing it and they seem to be safe, right? And now, today, why might you be quite hesitant in the midst of the coronavirus epidemic to not get on a plane and fly around? Ah, well, because people have done that and they got hurt, right? And they got sick. So I think if you want to get mass adoption for something, it's really about hunting down the first people who are willing to kind of dip their toe in the water, and then see if, you know, if the water is fine, right? Or if the water is, you know, too hot or too cold for their appetite. So, that at least gets us to a place to start, right? We're starting with technologies that are generally well known, and it's really about figuring out how they can best be combined together to create end-to-end solutions. And it's about finding specific use cases and specific use case partners to work with who are symbolic in their field and who have the risk tolerance to be first adopters of these kinds of systems. And after that, it's really about just lowering the barrier to entry, right? So once the first people have adopted a technology, then it's just about, you know, greasing the wheels through free software and free education to make it as easy as possible for people to move.
Yeah. And this is another unscripted question. Sorry, I have hard questions. So that's one approach. But what about this current coronavirus crisis? I think we could call it a crisis. And does this create new opportunities for, you know, communities like OpenMind and people like yourself to go in and say, you know, let's kind of skip the next 10 years, you know, gradually getting use cases and getting adoption, all of that. Maybe you could just jump over, leapfrog the next 10 years and go full on China on this problem, but in the Western world. So have you had any I know government organizations may be approaching you guys at OpenMind, or I know there's this Kaggle database. It's not exactly the kind of problem space that OpenMind is focused on, but anything related to coronavirus?
Sure. So, of course, I mean, our community, our Slack team has over 7,000 people in it. So there's quite a few things happening all the time that we are either actively or passively involved in. So like I myself am also a member of the United Nations Privacy Task Team, whose goal is to help identify and normalize and disseminate standards for what privacy preserving computation is. So from that standpoint, of course, we're fielding lots of phone calls and questions and queries around what the right tools are to use and in what context they should be used. And there are a myriad of projects in the community that are going on to trial out and to prototype and lower the barrier to entry to people being able to adopt. As to the first part of your question, it's really fascinating. As far as, you know, the world is all encountering a singular event. And when the world encounters a singular event kind of all at the same time, that singular event is going to going to drive some things. It's going to hold some other things back. And it will be interesting to see how something like coronavirus contextualizes privacy and privacy preserving technologies. For me, there's one thing I would like to share a bit of a tidbit of early. So there's this new field called structured transparency. And structured transparency starts by saying privacy is trivial to solve. Take all of your data and throw it away, right? From that standpoint, it's easy. What people don't like, it's not just privacy that people want, right? Because that would it's almost too easy, right? What people actually want is to maximize utility, right? To maximize the usefulness of their information while also maximizing privacy at the same time. And once you start to open up this idea of like, okay, how do we get the maximum amount of benefit with the minimum amount of risk? I don't think we're ever going to outgrow that trade-off. And what is commonly labeled as privacy tools are actually ways in which you can very precisely filter information so that you can release the information that you want to release without releasing the information you don't want to release. Like whenever someone says a privacy tool, that's what they're talking about, right? Because, you know, the best privacy tool is just the delete button. Mm-hmm. So I think... what something like coronavirus throws into sharp relief is a desperate need for these privacy tools to maximize utility. Because right now we are observing an extreme contrast, the potential for significant positive utility and significant negative utility given how we interact with coronavirus, right? So if for example, you were to do the sort of dystopian thing and just release everyone's location and everyone who has in contact with anyone else at any time, you would perfectly know like who was interacting with current and recent coronavirus patients, right? So you would seemingly maximize utility for preventing mm-hmm. coronavirus, but you wouldn't maximize utility, like you would minimize utility for potential secondary uses of that information. Because, you know, as it turns out, once we survive coronavirus, there's still going to be a world here, and there's still going to be governments, and there's still going to be people who want to do interesting things with location data.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side, if I don't release any information, right? Well, then what do we do? Do we, you know, sit around and twiddle our thumbs and wait? So this is where something like, you know, this is where the structured transparency framework enters the conversation and says, okay, what is the ideal information flow in a perfect world, right? With mm-hmm. where we were able to facilitate the movement of information in a perfect way. We would be able to like individuals who had been in contact with a coronavirus patient would learn that they had been in contact with a coronavirus patient. They wouldn't learn who it was. They wouldn't necessarily learn where it happened. They wouldn't learn how long ago it was. All they need to know is they need to self-isolate and go get tested, right?
Yeah.
And in a perfect world, those are the only people that would learn anything, right? In a perfect world, We wouldn't be asking the question of, do we throw it all into one big database, or do we not throw it into a database? Like, is it phone based or is it whatever? Like, in a perfect world, those are the people they want to inform, people who are recently exposed to go self-isolate. Right. And maybe there's one other, which is we want the aggregate statistics to be known by the CDC just so they know them. Right. But we don't necessarily, it's not our end desire for anybody to know everything there is to know about one specific patient, because that's not what's useful. What's useful is the numbers, like the general numbers of the general population. And the challenge is, how can we use, you know, these tools that are given to us, you know, a combination of on-device computation on mobile phones and encrypted computation such as homomorphic encryption, secure multi-party computation, differential privacy, zero knowledge proofs, to facilitate this movement of information, and just this movement of information, so that people who have come into contact with patients, and just people who became in contact with patients, came into contact with someone and still have no idea who it was, right? Because they don't need to know that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if we can design mechanisms for this precise movement of information, right? The ability to answer a specific question about data that you do not see, right? This is how we can maximize the positive utility while minimizing the negative utility, and get, you know, have our cake and eat it too, right? And get all of the gain with none of the cost. And that's why, like, these sort of privacy enhancing technologies is one phrase for them, or structured transparency technologies or privacy technologies seek to endow us with this ability to answer questions on data we can't see, and design the ability to move information such that specific people learn specific things and no one else learns anything else, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. This deserves to be an XPRIZE $1 million challenge around zero knowledge, non-location tracking, privacy-preserving AI solutions. Like, this could be the breakout moment, I think, for all of us, people who care about this cause.
And these use cases are everywhere. I mean, it's not even just machine learning. It really isn't. Like it's just the ability to answer, to facilitate a specific kind of information flow without allowing any other information flow. Like another good example is when you're walking into a club, right? And you're in downtown London or Paris or Barcelona or whatever, and the bouncer at the door says, "Ooh, I need to check that you're above a certain age," right? Does he learn that you are above a certain age, the bouncer, or do you hand them your ID and they learn your first name and your last name and your date of birth and your driver's license number and your nation of origin and and all sorts of information about you, right? When all they really need to know was, are you above a certain age, right? Like, this is like privacy preserving identity systems. It has nothing to do with machine learning, but oh, it's so impactful, right? All that is to say, like, it's even more than just machine learning. Like a society which can facilitate specific information flows is a society that is in its entirety better well-informed and better protected.
Yeah. I think I'm going to come back to, you know, sort of implementing these privacy-preserving solutions, and I have a more pointed question towards that. In your talks, you've often spoken about the relevance of differential privacy, federated learning, encrypted AI, and all under the umbrella of privacy-preserving AI. And it's like great phenomenal research. And now, while we understand these terms and we also understand the potential that they can bring and all these examples that you have given, how do you think that the business models or processes or entrepreneurs or even in corporates who are functioning at this point can implement these solutions?
So there's a few things to talk about that. The first question is why? Why would they implement these solutions? And there's a really simple answer that's sort of high level. They can reduce their amount of risk and increase their profits. And I think we're extremely fortunate as a society that, like, if these technologies do become mature, it actually becomes more profitable to preserve privacy. Let me explain what I mean. Let's say you're mapping a certain portion of the world, right? Maybe with satellites or whatever that normally other people can't see. Okay, so you have some data set that's proprietary. and it's valuable and potentially even has personal information. Using today's tools, or maybe yesterday's tools, if you were to make money from this, you would have two options. The first is that you can build an in-house team and create derivative applications that monetize this information in a specific way. And this is what a lot of people do. I mean, you could view most large tech companies as doing this in one form or another, right? But the trouble is that it's really difficult to scale a business like that, right? I mean, you either like because data has so many interesting uses, like the notion that you are going to be the one executing all of them just means that like you have to scale up operations just massively. I mean, imagine if you're a hospital network, right? And you're gathering sort of 360 degree view of people's medical records, right? Over the course of their entire life, like how many use cases are that? It's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of use cases, right? And so this just becomes like an operational nightmare to fully realize the value potential of a data set purely internally. Now there are of course some hospital networks that do this, particularly large ones. And the other option is to sell the data, right? And this, for small, medium-sized companies, is really the only option because they just the potential to reach the scale to be able to do all the different use cases yourself is just too daunting, right? For a lot of businesses. But there's another problem with selling data, and this is just simple supply and demand. As soon as I sell a copy of my data set to someone else, I have just doubled the supply. Right, and every single time I add a customer to my HubSpot, right, to my Salesforce, every single new customer that I have then becomes the competitor, right? And even if they aren't a competitor for the data set itself, they become a competitor for all the derivatives and all the applications of that data set, and that's the whole point of why they're buying it. And so this means that like the more that I sell, the less valuable it becomes, and this is why being in the data business is so challenging. However, if instead you work with privacy-preserving tools and you allow other people to develop applications and derivative products using your data without ever giving a copy of your data to anyone else, all of a sudden you get all the revenue without the increase in supply. Meaning whenever anyone wants to do anything with this kind of data, they still have to come to you. You still have billing power. And secondarily, you also have better pricing power. Because if I give you a copy of a data set, I have no real guarantees and even real knowledge how you're planning to use that data set, right? Like, and if I don't know how you're going to use it, I don't know how much cream to be trying to take off the top of you doing that. Like, you know, are you using pictures of parking lots to sell a security service for $10 a month? Or are you using pictures of parking lots to predict the stock price of Walmart, right? Which could potentially be millions and millions of dollars of revenue, right? So by keeping your data in-house, you decrease your legal liability, you increase your ability to know how to price, and you reduce the number of competitors significantly by not, you know, creating more competitors yourself, right? So it's more profit, it's higher prices, and it's less risk. And so like, and this is repeatable across every single business that is working with data that is either private or just inherently valuable. It's just proprietary, right? You know, sensor data on a particular model of automotive engine that no one else can gather, right? That will be that it's not private data. It's not, you know, you're not going to use it to affect anyone's insurance or whatever. It's just inherently valuable, and people shouldn't like businesses will make more money by not selling that as well. Right? And by instead having people use these privacy-preserving technologies to work with their data without being able to look at it. Does that make sense?
Yes, that answers my question very well. Also, like coming back to your work with OpenMind, could you share some specific examples where you feel that you have been able to solve problems as a community that had been existing for a long time? I mean, what would you consider milestones or achievements in that sense?
Great question. So You know, we get a related question to this quite a lot, which is why have we not incorporated into a startup or even a nonprofit, right? Why do we sort of remain this kind of open hand, decentralized, distributed community, right? Why be primarily volunteer focused when full timers can go a lot faster and these kinds of things? So OpenMind first started out of a realization that first, all these technologies needed to come together into a cohesive ecosystem of software, right? A second observation that basically the only places it was happening where people were combining, you know, machine learning and encrypted computation or encrypted computation differential privacy was inside of closed source startups, right? So it's happening in secret. You know, there would be a startup with like a famous cryptographer and a business person, right? That would then go and try to raise a bunch of money. And this is extremely typical for new technologies, right? So I actually lived through a lot of this in the natural language processing space. So there was a bunch of innovation that started in sort of academia and academic labs, maybe some industry labs, right? And it gets published in the form of papers. And then all the people who wrote the papers, who read the papers, do a bunch of closed source startups and try to sell software licensing. And then what happens next is eventually someone gets around to cobbling together a production level system in the open source. And then all these closed source startups go, uh-oh, because every sales meeting they go into, they, you know, someone will sit down and say, so your software looks great. And we have been paying $1 million a year for it. But now there's this open source thing like, you know, Apache Spark, or this open source thing like Linux, or this open source thing like Stanford Core NLP, or this open source thing like Spacey. Why should we be paying $1 million for your version of this technology, right? Or Hadoop MapReduce, right? Another good example. And then what happens is all the startups pivot and they go, oh, well, we're not about that. We're about applications. We're about apps, right? We deliver end-to-end services, right? These are just cogs in a machine. And like, yes, you can go and grab, you know, the Stanford Core NLP or the Linux or whatever, but that's not going to solve your problem, right? Your problem isn't you don't have it's like the difference between saying, yes, you can go get the free alternator online, but that's not going to drive you to the market, right? What you want is a car, and we're going to deliver you a car. And so like, you ask like why, what is something that we as a community have done really, really well? The number one thing that we have done is we've sped up this timeline by several years, by probably 3 to 5 years, by my guess. By sort of going straight at, right from the beginning, a production level, commercially available, Apache 2 free open source system for privacy preserving statistics and data analysis, right from the beginning. We kind of cut off a bunch of startups at the knees, right? And say like, don't bother, like don't build the open source stack using, you know, your 2 to 3 man team, because we're a dev team of nearly, you know, 100 people who are meeting week to week to build it for free, right? And give it away for free. And the hope is that instead of us going through the normal cycle for new technologies, where there's like this 5-year incubation period where a bunch of startups build a bunch of closed source stuff, that we can get all the startups to instead focus on deployments and applications that use this infrastructure within specialized industries, right? So instead of a startup saying, hey, we're a startup that's a platform for private AI, right? Or a platform for working for private data, you can do anything, right? We want them to say, hey, we're going to solve your problem in finance. We use all the standard industry standard tools for privacy preserving machine learning. And maybe we used to do it with standard machine learning tools before, but now we can do it even better because we have access to more data, right? And I think that if there's anything that we have done so far that I'm most proud of, it is bring the technology far enough forward where startups adopt us instead of trying to compete with us in the closed source, because it's a win for everyone, right? Because it means that the world is going to wait 2 to 3 years less for privacy preserving technologies to actually make it to their phones and make it to their desktop computers and deliver services in a privacy preserving way.
Right, right. I have to say, Andrew, it's kind of OpenMind has become unavoidable It's like the elephant community in the room.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. No, it definitely speaks to the success of the community as a whole. But I have kind of two follow-up questions. So one of them is, the first one is, I read your press releases or blog posts that you're kind of restructuring your approach at OpenMind. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. You're focusing, if I'm correct, on the kind of connective tissue that connects everything is the core team. And then you have these application focus or use case focus teams. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, last year and before that, most of our OpenMind, it was really a development and engineering organization. And we were focused first on combining these techniques and building sort of toy examples, right? And saying like, hey, here's a way that we think that say differential privacy and deep learning or like, and say not differential privacy and deep learning in general, but like differential privacy tools and deep learning tools can work together. And secure multi-party computation tools and deep learning tools like PyTorch and TensorFlow can work together. But you know, it's the kind of thing where like if you jump straight to like the heavy production system right from the beginning, then you don't really leave a lot of room for sort of exploring all the different ways these can be configured. And so we've kind of intentionally let the cement stay a little wet. And just tried lots of different things. I mean, and this has led to multiple different reboots of like the PySift code base, for example, as you know, we try it one way and then we get far enough down to sort of see how that's going. And then we learn something else and we try it a different way. And basically the pivot that we're making now is that we're reasonably confident that we know how these parts are going to play out. And so we're pivoting from being mostly demo focused to now being use case focused. So we opened up at the beginning of the year a new GitHub repository. It's just OpenMind/roadmap. And each of the dev and community teams is able to lay out there what they're working on week to week and what they're planning to work on over the next 6 months. And in the README of that roadmap, what you'll see is the high level plan for OpenMind for the year. And it is all about production use cases. It is all about, in particular, we've identified 7 use cases that we want to put into production for the first time this year. This references your other questions on like, how do you get people to adopt things? Like you hold their hand for the first time for the first player, right? And once you can show that it has been done, and it has been done with this stuff that's for free that you can totally grab, and we have mechanics and subsections of our community that are designed to help make it really easy for you. We'll introduce you to customers, we'll introduce you to engineers who know how to use it, and all these kinds of things. That's when the barrier is significantly lowered for adoption, right? So our plan for the year is really to form what we call partnerships, right? And like a partnership has 2 main components for each use case. So for say, the federated learning across enterprises use case, the 2 components of that partnership are a funding partner and a use case partner. And a funding partner, it doesn't have to be like funding in like the exact sense of like a check or something like that. It's really someone who's going to provide the resources necessary for development. Right. So this is someone who's like donating money to a charity to sponsor open source development, like actually paying our devs, which is what the PyTorch team did earlier this year. But this can also be, you know, a startup or enterprise that has a bunch of devs that they can put on this project and do open source development. Right. Like we haven't announced those yet, but we've got a couple of those in the works, which is great.
Maybe just for our very, very small audience. So but I heard about Aferis AI. That's one of them, right?
Yeah. So they're the other kind. They're a use case partner. So there's 2 components. So the development partners are the ones that are driving development and find the resources so the people can be in a chair writing code and doing that sustainably, right? But the use case partners, these are really exciting and these are really fun because it's just people who have a problem they want to solve and our community is going to rally around them to help them do it, right? And that's what, so we did announce this partnership with Aferis AI that's doing on-device federated learning, and it's fantastic for them, right? Because basically our community of people who've been working on this for years, and many of whom are on sponsored grants or through their unique situation as a grad student or with their enterprises able to work on this half time or full time, are able to come alongside them and say, hey, what do you need this software to do? Right. Mm-hmm. And to make it happen. And for us, it's hugely beneficial because we want to make sure that the software that we're building is what people need, right? We need good feature requirements. And until someone goes into the system and deploys it for real people to solve a real problem, we have no guarantee that what we're building is exactly what people need, right? So it's a beautifully synergistic relationship between us and our use case partners. And we're super excited to be working with Afiris on this particular use case as well.
Well, I feel like you read my mind. So my second question was, how do you guys are thinking about funding, or if you've considered these interesting funding approaches that various blockchain projects have pursued? Not all obviously successful, but that was my question. I think you kind of answered it. Do you have anything to add regarding, if you had thoughts before around going after that kind of funding, or if that's something that OpenMind would probably consider?
So at the moment, our funding comes from basically one source primarily, and then also crowdsource funding via Open Collective. At the moment, we probably could pursue lines of funding that were a bit more open-ended. But right now, I'm super excited for this model, primarily because, in my own personal experience of doing product development, when your money is attached to the value you create, you do a better job of creating value. And mm-hmm. in particular, we're most excited about the development opportunities that we have for these partnerships, where both the funding partner and the use case partner are the same entity. Right, because it means that someone is showing up and saying, "Hey, there's a specific thing that I want, and I'm going to make a lot of noise if it's not what I'm getting." Right, and in my experience, if you give someone sort of money to run in an arbitrary direction, mm-hmm. Unless you already have a well-defined amount of momentum, sometimes mm-hmm. that leads to a lot of exploration, which is also great. Like sometimes you want to exploit, sometimes you want to explore. I think the last year and a half have been a lot of exploration for us. And now is the time to like really, really hone down and do the exploitation step and like really, really, I guess exploitation sounds like a negative word. Really narrow in and deliver use cases. So having our source of community support tied to use cases at the moment is super, super positive. How that will change in the future will probably evolve as people actually start using our software. Mm-hmm. But I think we always want it to be tied to use. So maybe in the future we will look for people to sort of just sponsor the community generally because they're using the software, right? And they mm-hmm. want to be sort of be around and like this kind of thing. We would still have to kind of explore what that would be like. But in all cases, I think it should be. It's good when it's somewhat tightly coupled to use because it just keeps everybody focused. I think that's a really, really important thing, especially when you have such a distributed community, right? Like these sort of forcing functions of focus are important to get right. So I'm still learning on this. Like it's like we're definitely an odd duck. Like we're not a startup. We're not a nonprofit. We're like this distributed consortium of startups and enterprises and nonprofits and individuals and hackers and academics and YouTubers and getting everyone sort of aligned in the same direction is no non-trivial thing, and it's constantly changing. But at the moment, today, this is, I think, the been a really positive thing for us.
No, I mean, it absolutely makes sense, especially because you already have the kind of foundational layer of the tech stack built, and then you're looking for use cases. It's not the other way around. So it makes sense that you go after funding that is tied to customer. That's just kind of win-win. Andrew, I couldn't have wished for a better guest for the first episode. I think it's going to be the first episode. And believe it or not, I'm now heading to another meeting. We're trying to organize a decentralized online hackathon around decentralized AI for Very COVID-19. Cool. And I'll definitely, when we have more details, I'll share it with you and more openly with the OpenMind community.
Please do.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, no one's better than you guys to get involved. And again, huge thanks. It was an amazing episode. Diksha, anything from your side?
Oh, I got all of it covered, actually. It was great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm super glad to get to chat with you guys, and I hope you have an amazing podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Wish you an open mind and all your projects all the best. So thanks, everyone, for being with us for this episode, and see you in the next one.
Thank you.